From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, a noted expert says he uncovered billions of dollars of accounting fraud at GE.
All it takes is one or two or three bad CEOs and cooked books to end a legacy.
Could it be lights out for the iconic company? Also today, we go to the MFA to see how Howard Greenberg developed his love for photography.
If I had to put it in one word, it's magic. You know, I was turned on, so to speak, when I went into the dock room and developed a print.
And countering online hate and radicalization, and how the El Paso shooting is resonating with one Jamaica Plain father.
At some point, they are going to start asking questions. Why are these people being killed? And how do you explain to that, to your kids that, well, they were killed because they are brown?
It's all coming up next on Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. General Electric's light has gotten a little dimmer today. Noted accounting expert and Wall Street whistleblower Harry Markopoulos released a report alleging GE covered up just how dire its financial problems are, maybe to the tune of billions of dollars.
I think an icon of American business has been General Electric since 1909. That's a long time. And all it takes is one or two or three bad CEOs and cooked books to end a legacy and turn that into a legacy of, instead of fame, to shame.
WBUR senior investigative reporter Beth Healy spoke with Markopoulos and has been following the story, and she joins us now. Hello, Beth.
Hi there.
So tell us more about what this report found.
So in this 175-page report that Markopoulos posted online today, he alleges all kinds of accounting problems at General Electric, especially in two different parts of the company, the insurance group and its Baker Hughes Oil and Gas group.
And so give us a little more detail on that. Just how deep are these problems in the insurance unit and the oil and gas group?
Well, he's claiming that this could be multi-billion dollar hit to GE in terms of cash. For instance, that they need to put another $18.5 billion in reserves into their long-term care insurance group, something a lot of people might not even have known GE was in that business.
Yeah. So just how big of a trouble is this to GE?
Well, Markopoulos is claiming that this could be as much as $38 billion hit to GE, but that could possibly be overstating the situation. But GE is already under investigation by the SEC and the Department of Justice around some of its accounting practices. And so here you've got him coming with new areas that he believes they're understating their financial problems.
And actually, we have a little bit of tape here of him talking about just how dire the situation could be at GE.
GE has no cash. That's why they scaled back their plans. If you'll notice, they're selling their headquarters building. That's how desperate they need cash. Instead of putting in the amount of employees they promised the state, they're putting in only a percentage of those employees. This is a company in dire financial straits.
Dire financial straits. How did he uncover these dire financial straits?
So he and a group of forensic accountants and people from the insurance industry that he pulled together into a special group spent about the last 7 months looking into these issues. And they looked at public records and insurance filings and some quite complicated documents to
deep dive into the documents.
Exactly, to really pull apart GE's finances.
And what is GE saying in response to these allegations from Markopoulos?
So GE denies them completely. They say Markopoulos has never contacted them, has never spoken with them, doesn't know enough about their company to be making such serious allegations, and they stand by their accounting practices.
So one of the things that we've been seeing is that he says this could be the biggest insurance fraud case in the past 9 years, maybe even bigger than Enron. Is that possible given the numbers here, given what he's uncovered?
Well, it's hard to know about whether it's the biggest insurance fraud in the past 9 years, but this is a person who has a serious record of discovering wrongdoing in the numbers.
So he's a credible player here, is what?
Exactly. Markopoulos is the guy who tried to let the SEC know about Madoff years before the SEC was really taking it seriously. He's someone who went after State Street Bank and Mellon Bank for foreign currency problems, hundreds of millions of dollars that went back to investors. He also took on the MBTA pension fund.
Successfully so?
So in a couple of – in the pension fund case – the pension disputed his findings. However, they have had to make changes in the pension fund, and they're going to be moving forward to invest more of their money with the state.
But in this case, in the GE case, Markopoulos has a financial stake. And I should also say, Beth, that I do as well. I own a whopping 3 shares of GE stock, which are worth like $24. But I'm sure whatever stake he has is much higher than that. He's working with a hedge fund that's poised to benefit from GE stock declining. Is that typical for an investigation into a company like this?
So it's not. And this is a departure for Markopoulos himself. He claims that he did this because he wants to make money, because being an SEC whistleblower doesn't necessarily pay off. It can take years for those cases to come through and for him to get the money that he would expect to earn for blowing the whistle on people. So he went ahead and did this. He is getting criticism for that because people wonder, well, are you putting a hedge fund ahead of regular investors here?
And we heard at the top there him describing the long storied history of General Electric. And that's a story that's maybe well known to folks here in Massachusetts. It's an iconic American company. Thomas Edison, a huge presence at one point in Pittsfield, NBC, Jack Welch. And of course, that big announcement in 2016 that they were moving their headquarters to Boston from Connecticut. So how does all of this, this latest report, impact the health of the company overall?
Well, this is something that investors absolutely worry about, and they worry about whether they're getting the truth from Wall Street and from these companies. I spoke with Peter Cohen. He's a lecturer of strategy at Babson College and also an investor in General Electric stock. And he's somewhat skeptical about Markopoulos' report, but he's also worried.
If you know everything is wrong and all the numbers are overstated and the whole thing is fraud, then I think investors are going to lose confidence and lenders are going to lose confidence and the company could be in some serious trouble.
So, Beth, I want to ask you about maybe this crisis of confidence that Peter Cohen is talking about there, because it seems like every couple of years there's a new sort of corporate fraud case, Enron, WorldCom, Tyco, Madoff, as we talked about, the whole 2008 financial crisis. We've had Sarbanes-Oxley and Frank Dodd and other actions. So is there a bit of a crisis of confidence in Wall Street right now?
Well, CEOs still have to sign off on their numbers, and companies still have to be held to account for the numbers that they're putting out there. Mm-hmm. You know, what's going to happen next here is that he's going to Markopoulos filed his report with the Securities and Exchange Commission and with the Department of Justice, and they're going to be looking into his claims now as well.
Got it. And, of course, I said Frank Dodd there. I meant Dodd Frank, but put Barney Frank first. So Beth, you're going to stay on this story and you'll be following it to see what happens with the SEC.
Yes, I will.
All right. WBUR senior investigative reporter Beth Healy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more Radio Boston after a short break. I'm Jamie Bologna and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. It's been almost two weeks since the deadly mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. And now that we know more information, we want to revisit what could have led to these tragedies and consider how we might prevent these attacks in the future. Joan Donovan is the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy's Shorenstein Center. When we spoke earlier today, I began by asking if shooters display online warning signs that law enforcement and family should be more aware of.
So one of the things that we often see online is a proliferation of these manifesto-style threats. And so one of the problems with constantly reacting to warnings or constantly reacting to anything anybody posts online is you really tilt the power in favor of people who are potentially not going to be carrying out mass violence, but are interested in causing a lot of chaos and disruption. And there, from working with these platform companies as well, there really doesn't seem to be any particular pattern on large-scale social media platforms that would be indicative of saying, oh, when someone does this, then they are more likely to commit violence. However, if you look at other signs, including, you know, are they, you know, dressing up in fatigues and patrolling their neighborhood, as was happening in Nevada recently? Are they amassing large amounts of weapons? Then those are signs that someone might be teetering on the brink of committing some kind of violent act.
So then what's the role of websites like Facebook or YouTube or maybe less mainstream sites like 8chan, where the El Paso shooter had left this racist screed in sort of controlling or trying to control the spread of this hate online? I'm thinking of, you know, the Christchurch shooting and how Facebook spent 24 hours removing 1.5 million posts of that video. How do they control this?
That's a really important point, and that's something that we need to devote a lot more attention to. When we talk about controlling the spread, I think what we're really talking about is to what degree are we going to moderate for this online? It would behoove platform companies to think more about, well, when we see that this account or influencer is using racist language, to what degree do they limit the amplification of that content? Do they restrict it to people who are already subscribed? Do they put it on a do not recommend list? For instance, Spotify doesn't recommend hate rock bands. And so even though there might be hate rock bands on their platform, they don't put them into their recommendation systems. And so there's ways in which platform companies can intervene, both from completely banning or deplatforming or taking down content, all the way towards using the algorithmic systems and recommendation systems that they've built to either throttle the spread of this content or to remove it from reaching new audiences that weren't even looking for it in the first place.
But at the same time, it does seem like there's a bit of a whack-a-mole going on the internet, and that there's this tension between free speech online and accountability and countering extremism. I've been thinking a bit about the Tsarnaev brothers and their radicalization online before the marathon bombing. But there's other kinds of organizing that can also happen online that might not, you know, be radicalization in a sense, the Hong Kong protests or the Arab Spring. So how do you balance the good with the bad and deal with this whack-a-mole problem?
Yeah, I think it's really important that we not conflate the content, right? So when we see something where people are using online technologies to coordinate for increased rights, to coordinate for, in the case of Hong Kong, really important civil rights, that we don't conflate the content and the use of the technologies as either all uses are bad or all uses are good. Of course, we've had mass shootings. We've had all of these problems, misogyny, racism prior to the internet. The issue is, to what degree does this technology amplify or exaggerate or magnify these problems and increase the capacity for people who would be considered fringe or ideas that would be considered fringe to reach into the mainstream and to really shape the way in which the public discusses their crimes.
But who should be making these decisions about what's okay and what's not online?
Well, that's a really good question. We don't have any regulation that's going to, in any in the U.S. context anyway, set those standards. And so we're in a situation in the U.S. that is different from the situation in Germany, where there are standards set by the government that require websites not to share and sell Nazi paraphernalia and propaganda, for instance. And so there are ways of doing internet content moderation in other countries that we can look to as models. In the U.S., there's issues around what we call free speech and what it is really meant to be. So the free speech has a lot to do with what you can say to and about the government. However, if you own a business and someone comes in and is screaming about, you know, any kind of racist language, you can't just walk into a business and do that. You can't just walk into a hotel lobby and say, you know, I want all of the immigrants to leave. You can't do that. People are going to kick you out. But online, we don't have the same methods or ways of moving people around. And so we do rely heavily on these companies, perhaps too much, to set those standards, and those standards become very uneven. This perpetuates the problem of whack-a-mole, because we see people who want to traffic in hate speech or want to share these manifestos and these ideas will move around between platforms if they do find themselves getting resistance from one.
And in your research, you often make the point that the media, in some ways, unwittingly helps spread white supremacists and other extremist ideologies following attacks or mass shootings. And so looking back on the last couple of weeks, did the coverage of the El Paso shooter's racist screed disturb you?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a lot different than what we were dealing with 2 years ago. So while we still have ways to go, the media is now attuned to that they shouldn't be promoting these people's names, that they shouldn't reprint the manifesto in total without giving any kind of warning or context to their audiences. They also know now not to link back to anonymous message boards or white supremacist message boards where their readers can then go and potentially fall down the rabbit hole. So I think media has changed, but I'll tell you the one thing that I'm especially proud of the media for doing is I didn't see any evidence of the media going to white supremacists in particular and giving white supremacists a new platform to explain these ideas. Now, a few years ago when we saw these kinds of things happening, different events, oftentimes what journalists would go right to white supremacists to try to validate these ideas. And I was a big proponent of what we call strategic silence, which is to say journalists should provide the context. They should explain the violence. They should explain what happens. But under no circumstances should they go to a white supremacist to validate these ideas and to give that person notoriety.
So I hear you on that. And part of what we try to do on this show anyway is offer that context and understanding of the facts, and motives is something that does come up as we struggle to understand the why in a seemingly nonsensical, terrible tragedy like El Paso or Dayton. So how should we better cover mass shootings where there are these breadcrumbs, these memes, these online trails that get left behind?
I think that there's a few different stories that we can always tell about what we might want to start describing as domestic terrorism events, which is to say that readers and audiences should understand that the reason for the violence isn't random. It's to ensure that whatever breadcrumbs that are left online are read and reread and amplified through the media ecosystem. And so journalists have to understand that there are different ways they can tell those stories. And part of those stories that journalists should be telling isn't just about the politicians' reactions or, going to the manifesto and reading key passages, but that journalists should think about, well, what are the impacts on the community here? How are people going to go on with their days? How are they going to live through this? As well as how are the targeted communities, in this case in El Paso, he was targeting what he believed to be immigrants. But of course, we know that there are plenty of U.S. citizens that live and that live in the community of El Paso. But, you know, we need to.
And do you mean just the community of El Paso, or, you know, there was racist language in his screeds against the Latinx community? So do you mean also the Latinx community?
Both. I would say that we also need to turn our attention to, well, what are the civil society organizations like the National Hispanic Media Coalition that are assembling these impact stories and are dealing with the trauma that's been inflicted upon this community, and how do they want media to change, right? We have to look at and listen to, well, how do these victims of these crimes, but then this community, what responses are they asking for, and what ways in which do they want to interact with the media? And we also need to understand that throughout this, that there are many stories of resilience and of people coming together through this. And that also, one thing that strikes me that we're not covering in the media is interracial solidarity, which is to say that what happens in moments like these isn't that communities go and lock their doors and don't come together, but that they come together and there are vigils and meetings and ways in which the community does come together in resolve and resilience in reaction to events like this. And so the more the media can cover those stories, the better we're going to be when we confront the next wave of violence. Because unfortunately, when we turn our attention to these waves of violence and we don't show that they're not effective, then the next person is inspired to do more violence because they believe they're winning.
Joan Donovan is the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy's Shorenstein Center. Joan, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Let's turn now to Franklin Peralta. He's a Dominican U.S. citizen, a Jamaica Plain resident, father of two daughters, and a campaign organizer with English for New Bostonians. Franklin, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you just heard Joan Donovan there, and of course, I'm not asking you to speak for an entire community, but what responses are you looking for personally?
I would say, adding to what she was saying, is the same thing. It's like focusing on the lost, on the life that were lost, and all what they are contributing to our communities. These are hardworking people that are really contributing to the economy, contributing to the society where they live. That should be the focus, what we have lost here.
What was the focus in your family?
It was a tough situation because we were scheduled to go out to a protest on Sunday. The association of people that have to do with mass incarceration and jails were having their convention here, and everything is connected, and we were going to protest them because we should stop putting people in jail as a business, making profit out of that. So when the shooting happened, I was scared, man. I was thinking that maybe I should stay home, maybe I shouldn't take my daughters to a public demonstration where these people may have guns. We know that these events inspire the next one, and I was trying to think how to deal with the situation. I told my wife, "Well, maybe I or you can stay home with the kids, and one of us goes out." And that's where it hit me that's exactly what white supremacists are looking for. They want this is a case of not just domestic terrorism, but like terrorism, period. They want to put fear on our hearts. They want us to stay home and not come out and protest this. So with a big hole in my stomach, I took my two daughters and we went out and we said we need to stop this.
There were reports today that the Rhode Island Attorney General is investigating claims that someone drove a truck into a group of protesters at a detention facility in that state. So you did decide to take your daughters to that protest. But how do you talk to them about what happened in El Paso?
We will have to talk to them because, as I was saying, there is going to be a point. Like, we are big listeners of WVUR. We have the radio all the time, and they are going to start asking questions. They are going to start asking questions. Why are these people dying? Why is somebody trying to kill us? They, you know, they are biracial and bicultural, and they say I'm a Dominican American. They were born here of a Dominican father. They carry their Latino heritage with pride, and when they overhear that was exactly what was target, that these white supremacists came out to kill Latinos, to kill Mexicans, they are going to ask why. And I don't have an answer for that. I mean, I could say, explain the whole thing with the identity crisis that many white people are going through and how they need a scapegoat. But come on, there are 60 million Latinos in this country. We are abiding by the law. We are doing what we are asked to do in terms of contributing to the economy, trying to create and revitalize communities. So it's really tough when at the same time you feel like you have to go home and hide behind your bed.
And, you know, we talked a bit with Joan Donovan from Harvard's Shorenstein Center a little earlier about the media coverage of the hate-filled screed from the El Paso shooter, and which the FBI says he posted online before the attack. And I'm just wondering, for you, when hearing reports of what was written of this sort of Hispanic invasion of Texas or this idea of a great replacement that is propagated by white supremacists, that white people are being replaced by people of color, how does that make you feel?
It makes me feel horrible because words matter, and you have this has been incentivized from the White House, like this, putting a whole community of millions of people in one basket and saying bad things and talking about invasions and talking about murderers and rapists. I mean, it was just a matter of time, right, that these words materialize in this horrible crime that we just saw, and it will continue. I have to say, though, that a lot of people think that, oh, we just have to get rid of the current president and everything is going to be normal. No. I see him as a symptom of a big problem that we have in this society, where the balance of power and the balances of identities are being questioned. You know, they say that this is the first generation that cannot expect that their kids are going to be a better future. Well, if you come from a poor country like myself, that doesn't apply, right? I am expecting my kids to have a better future than what I had. But there are many families here that's a reality. There are many families here that for generations, they had, like, the father had one job and they were able to sustain their family with a job. Maybe that the mother stay home and take care of the kids. All that is coming down. And you have a person in the White House that is promising to bring all that back to this family just because he's singling out one group and say they are the one that we have to blame. How are we immigrants to be blamed for the reality that many people are living, where their world is being shaken and they cannot expect that their kids are going to do better than themselves?
So what do you say to the folks then who feel like their world is being shaken, as you just described?
Yeah, I think we have to come together. When we talk about inclusion, we are not talking about, oh, you have to leave the place so I can come in. Inclusion means another thing. Inclusion means working together. Inclusion means let's find out who's manipulating, who's getting richer and richer in this economy, and who's getting the best part, and who's beneficiating from putting us to fight each other. that's what we should be focusing, trying to come together. And we see many examples through history of people coming together and really trying to remove the mask from the people that are behind, beneficiating from putting us to fight.
So over the weekend, NPR Weekend Edition host Lulu Garcia Navarro wrote a piece for The Atlantic that said the media erased Latinos from the story, meaning the story of the El Paso shooting. You read the news, you follow the news. Do you think there's been enough conversation about the actual specific targeting of Latinos in El Paso?
Absolutely not. I don't think so. I can tell you, I've been in this country for 12 years. Many of my family and friends are in the Dominican Republic. They cannot even start to understand why this violence is taking place, why all this mass shooting, why targeting specific groups. I can tell you, if this were happening in the Dominican Republic or in Colombia or in Venezuela, that dozens and dozens of people are being gunned down because who they are, the conversation will be very different. Right now, we will be talking about, you know, the Association of American States, the United Nations. They will be talking about economic sanctions against that country. They may be talking about military intervention to stop the killings. And here, it's just like it stay in the news for 2 days, and then we move on. You know, why is that? We need to stop this. I have two daughters, and I want them to be safe when they go to a park, to their schools, to their church. And everything is connected. Like, why is this happening here and it's not happening in other countries? We need to keep asking that question.
So I guess in thinking about your daughters, what are the conversations that they're having with their friends?
You know, we try to protect them the most that we can, but they know that the only way that we can have a healthy society is by really coming together. And they see that in their schools. There are kids with some more privilege than others. There are kids of different colors, of different races and class and social class. But they see that as a place where they come together and they can be kids. Where are we losing that when our kids are growing? There is a moment there where this is lost, and we start seeing the other as the enemy. You know what I mean? Like, it's so easy to say, oh, the problem is the White House, the problem is the media. We have many, for example, undocumented Latinos here in Massachusetts. We've been trying to pass laws to protect them, to allow them to be trained and to drive on the street safe. And we cannot pass those laws. We want them to go to the community colleges and have in-state tuition. And again, more than a decade trying to get in-state tuition that other places around here and other even states like Utah already many years ago passed. So, you know, we can talk a lot about the problem is the media, the problem is the White House. And at the same time, we are not doing what we can do to protect Latinos and Latinas here in Massachusetts.
I guess, though, at the same time, and I know sometimes after tragedies, the conversation can get muddled between a real discussion about a real issue and maybe a shooter's motivation. So mm-hmm. I don't want to do that. But I do want to acknowledge that there is a legitimate conversation to be had in this country about immigration, about
Absolutely.
Legal and illegal immigration, about what to do about asylum seekers and detention centers. And how do we have that conversation apart from the El Paso shooting in a way that's constructive and actually moves the conversation forward?
I think
– because there are legitimate concerns there from some folks that there are folks who broke the law who came here, or there's, you know, limited resources to support – asylum seekers here in the country. So what is your...
Yeah. Let's take, for example, what happened in Mississippi, where they have those raids and almost 700 people were arrested. they were processing chicken. They were processing chicken. How is that?
The ICE raids.
Yes, the ICE raids. How is taking these people from their families? How is that making this this place more safe? How is making this this country having more jobs available? You see what I mean? Like, what we are trying to do here is to bring our hardworking ethics and our desire to contribute to a society. And we are being met by all these lies about, oh, they are taking jobs. Oh, they just want, they are freeloaders. How can you be a freeloader and also take the jobs? You know what I mean? Yeah. Let's have the conversation.
So finally, I want to ask you, after El Paso, how are you moving forward personally?
It's tough because I know it's going to happen again, man. It's going to happen again because nothing has changed. You know, I really, it hits me hard every time I hear the police and the media repeating, the shooter acted alone. No, he didn't. Somebody built that gun. Somebody sold that gun. Somebody is paying Congress to not do anything about taking these weapons of war from the hands of civilians. So I go out every day and I look around and like, it's going to happen here? Where is the next town to have this massacre and these strategies happening? So I feel bad because I know it's going to happen again.
That's Franklin Peralta. He's a Dominican U.S. citizen, a Jamaica Plain resident, and a campaign organizer with English for New Bostonians. Franklin, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Jamie Bologna. Stick with us after a short break. This is WBUR's Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. On display now at the MFA are some of the 446 photographs that are recent additions to the museum's photography collection. They include works by Dorothea Lange, Henri Cartier-Bresson, and Diane Arbus, and they are from the collection of Howard Greenberg. Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell went to the exhibit and met up with Greenberg. Hi, Zoe.
Hi, Jamie.
So, Howard Greenberg, he's not a household name, so tell us the role he played in the history of photography.
Howard Greenberg is a part of this pretty small circle of people who really developed the modern photography market. You know, the group includes curators, historians. Greenberg is a gallery owner and art collector. He founded what's now named the Howard Greenberg Gallery in New York back in 1981. But he really got his start taking, collecting, and selling photographs in Woodstock, New York.
Okay, so we're going to get to the actual pictures in just a second. But what did Greenberg tell you at this MFA exhibit last week?
Yeah, so it opened officially this weekend, but he was there setting up. And on the walls were, as I said, 150 of these vintage photographs, as he calls them, from the 20th century. And I asked him about, you know, how he acquired such an extensive collection and what really got him hooked on photographs in the first place.
If I had to put it in one word, it's magic. You know, I was turned on, so to speak, when I went into the dock room and developed a print. You know, you put a blank piece of paper into the chemicals and suddenly this image comes up. It's pretty special for the first time. And I'm not the only one who felt that way. I mean, a lot of people have printed photographs and had that same sense of, wow, this is magic. So I always felt that the photographic print was an amazing thing to behold. It was an amazing thing to create when I was a photographer, but even more amazing when I started to discover older photographs with older materials and processes that I couldn't do because the materials weren't available anymore. And that really got me. And I loved it. And the show in my collection is all about that. It's about vintage photographs, and yes, there's history and many things, but for me, the most important element is that it's the right print of that image, because there could be many prints. It's photography. There's a negative. You can, you know, duplicate it and all that, but, you know, with vintage photography, each one has its own unique properties, its own unique look, and for me, that's what makes it so special.
I'd love to hear about how you found so many of these prints. Like, what's the process like, and how do you recognize when you found something that has that magic? That's
a good question. It comes out of obsession. I don't know how else to describe it. I'm a collector by nature. You know, I collected baseball cards and so on when I was a kid, but I used to comb the auctions. I lived upstate, and I'd get to Newtown B, and I listed all the auctions all over New England, and if I saw old photographs or, you know, certain names that I'd been learning about in the history of photography, I might drive 100 miles just to go to that auction and try and buy something. In Woodstock itself, a lot of the older artists I met, families of artists, they had photographs. So, you know, that was a great deal of it. And also, in those days, you could find great work. It was out there. The market hadn't really developed yet. Things weren't expensive. People weren't looking for them for the most part. And so I enjoyed hunting for old photographs. I enjoyed finding things in attics and flea markets and so on. And it all kind of, you know, came together in that way.
Yeah. And can you talk a little bit more about that? I'd love to hear about how the art world kind of viewed photography at the time you started, you know, taking photography and collecting photography. So like the 1970s, 1980s.
Well, there was pretty much still a strong stigma against considering photography on an equal, you know, plane as other media, painting, sculpture, whatever. Photography always had that problem. It changed a little bit by the 1970s, but not that much. And in my home of Woodstock, at the Artists Association, which was founded in 1930, they actually had in the bylaws that, and I quote, the photographers should hang themselves in the basement. And it really did say that. It meant they should hang their own exhibitions in the basement. Well, that kind of got my juices flowing. I thought, I have to do something for photography here in Woodstock.
We're talking about gallery owner and art collector Howard Greenberg and his personal collection of photographs. 446 are now owned by Boston's MFA, and 150 are on display. And Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell is still here. She went to the exhibit. So what are some of the standouts?
Yeah, so Greenberg and I walked through the gallery together, and he pointed out a few of his favorites, two of which were by Dorothea Lange. She's an American documentary photographer, best known for this photograph, Migrant Mother.
Yeah, that's the well-known photo of the mother with her two children taken during the Great Depression.
Yep, pretty iconic, comes to everyone's mind, from 1936. And, you know, at one point he actually told me he had this hanging in his home, which was pretty crazy. You know, he says he was worried that it might be too depressing of a photo to have around his young children at the time. I thought that was interesting. And that's one in the exhibit. Another by Lang is called Plantation Owner, Mississippi Delta, near Clarksdale, Mississippi. That's also from 1939. And this
36.
One I, 36, sorry. This one I wasn't familiar with. It features a larger white man. You know, he's wearing suspenders, this brimmed hat, and he's outside this country store. There's like a Coca-Cola sign on the wall, and he's kind of leaning against an automobile. And behind him on the stairs, there's four African-American men. And everyone's kind of looking to one side of the photograph. There's no engagement with one another. Here's Greenberg.
And you right in tell the corner. He's got a certain power over them. I mean, you feel it, right?
Yeah.
And he did. I'm sure he's the guy who was, it was either his farm or the manager of the farm where they were working. He was employing them or maybe barely employing them. You know, it really talks about the relationship between, you know, the local white guy from Mississippi and the African-Americans who are maybe second, third generation slaves.
And most of the time, that's the photograph people have seen, you know, mm-hmm. but it's actually this cropped version. So in this print that Greenberg owns, which came from the full negative, you're able to see something else in the corner. You know, it's a part of another man's face. And Greenberg kind of feels, and he's looking at this group of men, and Greenberg feels this changes the dynamic of the piece.
Mm. Why I like this is because this picture is usually reproduced with this person whose little piece of his face cropped out. And when you look at this picture this way, it becomes a very symbolic photograph. you know, the black workers, the tough old Southern guy who controls them. You can read a lot into it, and it's a very, I think, charged photograph. But when I saw this print, that person, who you can barely see, but he's not cropped out because it's the whole negative, is Paul Taylor, who was Dorothy Lange's husband. And what's going on is they're really just talking to each other. You know, it's a very simple moment. And I like that idea that, you know, the reality of photographs, sometimes you have to wonder if what you're seeing is the way it really is, or what you're not seeing is the way it really is.
So he's kind of saying this photograph is really just showing a moment, you know, of conversation between these men and Lange's husband, you know. But as a viewer, you know, even that simple moment for me, you know, the race and power dynamics are still pretty visible, you know, kind of looming over that moment.
So race and power and the MFA, of course, this reminds me of what played out there this summer, where a group of students of color on a field trip were harassed by MFA patrons and staff. That context has to be there. So did you ask him about that?
Yeah, I did ask him about that. You know, when walking around the exhibition myself, I was kind of thinking about that idea. You know, photography is, in my opinion, one of the more easily accessible art mediums for people. You know, you can take photography, you can look at it and see humans, faces, emotion. And Greenberg has said before that he really insists on making his gallery a friendly gallery. So I asked him whether he thought photography could aid in kind of opening up these museum spaces. And his answer surprised me. You know, he's also a businessman and was focused on the role the market plays.
I mean, the only way today to make a conscious effort in doing that would be to show, to maybe seek out and show more women artists and more African-American artists, because those are the two genres, if you will, I don't know if that's the right word, where the politics lie today. You know, everybody wants more of each of those categories, at least in America. And museums are well aware of that. I think it's obvious if you look at the shows and you look at the conversations in public. And galleries generally will reflect that because the market will reflect that.
Yeah, it's like a business answer, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that art, capital A art, has always been a field where business aesthetics, scholarly work and opinions, they all go hand in hand. You know, without the business, there's really no art. And that goes back to, you know, the Middle Ages. The artists have to have a way of surviving. Therefore, there has to be a marketplace. And it's nothing new, you know, galleries, yeah. Museums, artists, and so on. They all kind of work together in one way or another.
So, of course, that answer is not going to be enough for everybody, and it's definitely not the whole solution to this issue. Mm-hmm. But what I take away from it is that Howard Greenberg is hopeful that a growing demand for a more diverse range of artists will matter, and maybe that's one way we see these spaces open up and more fully represent our society going forward.
Radio Boston's Zoe Mischel, always a pleasure. Thank you for bringing this to us.
Thank you, Jamie.
Viewpoint, photographs from the Howard Greenberg Collection, opened last weekend and will be on display at the MFA through the middle of December. Fifty years ago today, nearly 500,000 people traveled to a farm in a small New York town for what would become arguably the most iconic music festival of all time. Woodstock was messy, crowded, and unorganized, and yet the musical performances and the joyous celebration of the counterculture of the 60s turned the three-day festival into a moment that helped define a generation. The lineup was a who's who of rock stars: Santana, Joan Baez, Janis Joplin, The Who, Sly and the Family Stone, and of course, Jimi Hendrix. Hendrix's performance closed out the festival on a high note.
Excuse me while I kiss this guy.
But if we were to boil Woodstock down to one performance of one song from a comfortable perch 50 years later, it has to be his powerful take on the national anthem. At a time of national turmoil, on the heels of the civil rights movement, with the Vietnam War raging, Hendrix's anthem captured the moment, and some considered the anthem controversial or disrespectful. But Hendrix himself disagreed. Here's how he described it while being interviewed by Dick Cavett about the performance.
This man was in the 101st Airborne, so when you write your nasty letters in... When you mention the national anthem and talk about playing it in any unorthodox way, you immediately get a guaranteed percentage of hate mail from people who say,
That's not unorthodox.
It isn't unorthodox?
No. I thought it was beautiful.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Jamie Bologna. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.